This episode of The Python Perspective is brought to you by Jersey Cream Psychiatrists, the only psychiatric clinic to offer you a complete Freudian analysis of your mother issues and breast fixations while providing you with the fresh dairy products that will give you a substitute for a true neurosis-free lifestyle.
Mrs. Ratbag, if you don't mind me saying so, you're badly in need of an expensive course of psychiatric treatment. Now, I'm not going to say a trip to our dairy will cure you, but it will give hundreds of lower-paid workers a good laugh.
Patients with lactose intolerance may experience limited results, while also suffering from catatonia, psychotic breaks, acute insecurity, and whatever else we can think of that you can afford to be diagnosed with. Welcome to The Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Nathan, physicist, improv comedian, and actor.
Hello, Ben. Good to be back. Here we are talking about the third episode of Series 2 called Deja Vu.
The third episode as aired on the 29th of September in 1970, but this was actually considerably different in production order. In fact, there is a moment very early in the episode where Michael Palin's character, dressed up as a bishop, says that this is episode 5.
No, nothing to do with me. I'm not in this show. This is show 5. I'm not in until show 8.
Oh, I see.
I'm just learning my lines, you know?
So this was filmed on the 27th of July, several months earlier, but was bumped too early in the proceedings. So I think that they felt that this was a fairly strong episode. What about you, Nathan? How do you feel about it in terms of success and failure and strength?
I would agree that there are a lot of positive attributes and strong writing and good production value in terms of the film. There's a lot of filmed bits in this episode. However, I do think this episode suffers from kind of a poor use of time.
Ha, that's ironic.
It is. And the reasons I think so, I'm going to actually kind of wash over some of my favorite moments and favorite sketches as I talk through this, but there's a lot of time spent just kind of having camera pan over people walking, which at first kind of is a little bit comical because a lot of it is out of context. People are walking ostensibly to some job interview at some office building in an urban setting. Clearly, they're just out in the middle of the woods. That's kind of funny. But then there is a good 2 minutes of a camera poised on a street. And you can hear the audio of people walking and you hear the footsteps, but it sounds to me like they didn't have quite all of the elements to fill the full 32 minutes, and they're really stretching it out. There are other repeated jokes, which to me ring very flat. For example, there's not one, but two quasi-hijackings of an airplane where somebody lurches into the airline cockpit. One of them, Michael Palin, is actually trying to hijack the plane, taking it to Luton. But the one that before that is Graham Chapman thinking the cockpit is the bathroom.
Ah, that's better. Oh, my God. I'm terribly sorry. I thought this was a ballet toilet.
This is the control cabin.
And that dialogue just feels very stilted and unanimated. You've mentioned before that sometimes sketches seem like they were tossed together ramshackle last minute just to fill the space. Mm-hmm. Graham Chapman in the cockpit feels like that to me. Hmm. So there's two indications where I feel like they were trying to stretch the time. And there's the third on my list here. There's a couple of, you know, Ewan McTeagle, he rants and you can't really understand what he's saying. It feels like the joke has gone on just a little bit too long. And where I feel they really could have used that time better is when they actually get to the deja vu portion, when they actually start to repeat and loop the same thing over and over again. They only have time to do it maybe 3 or 4 times before the credits run out.
The episode guide to this that came with the network Blu-ray box set written by Andrew Pixley specifies that this episode, as originally scripted, The final script was finalized. That's redundant, but, you know, deja vu. Let's just use words over and over again. On the 27th of April in 1970. So a decent chunk of change between the final writing date and the filming dates. That this episode originally ended with Election Night Special. So there was, in fact, going to be a huge chunk of episode at the end of it that they cut for time. So the question then becomes, did they play looser with the editing of this episode in order to stretch it out a little bit in places? Or did they like the loose edited feel of it? Did they like the more pastoral, surreal aspects of things not happening in a quick and active fashion? And that's why they cut the Election Night Special, was because they wanted to preserve those moments. Now, I don't have anything that indicates one way or the other, but I'm just going to present those two possibilities to you on a plate and say, do you feel like this episode stretched? Or do you feel like Election Night Special was cut because they wanted to preserve the timing that they had?
Seems more like the first one. I mean, Election Night Special is a pretty long sketch, as I recall.
Yes, it is.
Upwards of over 5-6 minutes. And that's a lot of time to stretch out. So seeing as how what I just said about things being kind of inserted and they feel a little bit longer, to me, I think they're just trying to stretch for time without having a whole lot of new content to really justify that stretching.
The only one where I really feel like you might be right is Graham entering into the pilot cockpit thinking that it's a bathroom, because most of that is done in studio. Obviously, we have the insert of him dropping into the bale of hay outside the restroom. And Pixley tells us that that restroom is very close to the BBC studios. So that could have been a filmed bit that was done as a pickup. Whereas the rest of it, the long walks in the wilderness, walking through ponds and streams and fields and seasides, all of those would have had to have been filmed much prior to this. So that, I think, wouldn't have been, from a production angle, able to have been stretched. It would have had to have been planned.
Yes, that is true. I would also add that the deja vu section, where they're actually beginning to repeat things, part of that is filmed too. So that clearly was a choice in the original production to film these early on so they could have those film segments back to back. And sometimes they loop segments, which are, it's a similar take, but the lines are different. So they actually filmed multiple things, multiple takes. My feeling is that, at least with that, they didn't go far enough with the repetition. And I feel like time would have been better used if they had actually delved a bit deeper into the actual deja vu portion.
I love the deja vu portion. It is hands down somewhere in my top 10 Monty Python sketches of all time. And it's all down to Palin's performance, because the repetition and the editing and the sound mixing of the theme song are all phenomenal, but it's the increasing frenetic energy that Palin brings to his anxiety built around how much he's freaking out because he's experiencing deja vu.
Good evening. Tonight on It's the Mind, we examine the phenomenon of deja vu.
Because he's experiencing the show that he's presenting over and over and over again.
That strange feeling. No, fine, thank you, fine. Thank you. Look, something's happening to me. I think I better go and see someone.
That, to me, is such a dynamite performance that it is a little sad that the sketch ends with a fade out under the credits. It doesn't actually have a conclusion. And obviously part of that is because it was supposed to transition into Election Night Special. It wasn't supposed to be the episode's ending. But the other part of it is that the Pythons traditionally don't necessarily end sketches. They don't have a button on everything. And so to have it not have a full conclusion is a disappointment that I usually sort of edit out of my memories and just stay with the memory of how good Palin is in that bit.
Yeah, the very end where the credits are rolling, the filmed bit is the same thing. And they just change when he comes into the office and talks to Dr. Cream, and they put Dr. Cream's mustache in a slightly higher portion of his face, which I love. that's all studio.
Right.
So the fact that they ended it when they did, they sort of conceded, okay, well, we don't have enough time to push this further, even if we wanted to. And my own take is that is a directing mistake. Mm. I think they could have easily gotten rid of the Graham Chapman bit in the cockpit, maybe shorten some of the other bits to give themselves another minute or two to really drive that wheel of Palin running into Dr. Cream's office.
Yeah.
So time management is my main complaint with this episode.
Well, I am going to stand up for the extended pastoral bits. I love Carol Cleveland walking Terry Jones through the sides. I love the repeated moments of seeing that cast of characters of Palin as the auditioning bishop and the tea lady and all of those characters every time they show up in another sketch in another time. I mean, it's a very simple comedic trope to say, oh, I recognize that, and it makes you feel good. A callback is one of the cheapest laughs available because it relies on the snap of closure of the audience member saying, oh, that's a thing that I recognize, which isn't tough. It isn't particularly refined as a comedic technique, but it doesn't mean that it isn't highly successful. And so for me, the fact that it exists in kind of a episode cinematic universe where all of these people are blending one into the other, because also that's where Owen McTeagle, despite the fact that he's a Scottish poet, is also wandering through the same glen with the exploding animals. It's all interconnected in a subspace dimensional impossibility that wouldn't work but makes me happy.
Okay.
So now that we've established the sort of the scope of the episode and the main aspects about it, that it is a slightly slow-paced, self-referential Ouroboros of an episode, do you want to talk about your three favorite sketches?
I do. But before I do, I started off with a little bit of a here's what I don't like.
Yeah.
I do want to flip the switch on that and give some props to things which haven't really come up yet in our discussion.
Please.
So, series two, they're using John Cleese as sort of the front man, where it may have been the It's Man in series one. Now it's John Cleese sitting at some desk randomly somewhere saying,
and now for something completely different.
I love that. I really love that. Because every single time it's a different place and he's in a totally different context. And I love how they're using that in series two. So that's a shout out to that choice.
So you find that John Cleese's character of the presenter being put into new context, you find that more successful than the recontextualization of the abuse of the It's Man at the beginning of each first series episode?
I do. Part of that is just John Cleese's demeanor as being the presenter, and that he's how good he is at being the guy behind the desk, either bringing a lot of gravitas to what he's saying, being really kind of frantic, to being a little more flippant about it. And I think he kind of strikes a very nice balance at being the guy he is in the situation he is and maintaining a seriousness to his tone. I find that really, really funny. I would also give applause to the group for a very creative use of explosions. I'm not familiar with pyrotechnics enough to know what kind of explosion they use that is very loud but yields no shrapnel and is therefore safe to use with a full production team and actors close by. But I like how they use this to great effect, especially in this episode, but also previous episodes and definitely future on.
Yes, yeah, this will come up very distinctly in our next episode. But at the moment, I think we talked about this with regard to the funniest joke in the world. The Pythons dressed as soldiers running through a recreation of the front lines, and they had explosions going off all around them while they were reading out nonsense German. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I believe you also said, boy, that must have taken some doing. That must have been a real tough one to measure with health and safety.
Yeah. But I like how they have gotten over whatever complications there are, technical and bodily, and made it work.
And I look forward to both How Not to Be Seen, which has some wonderful explosions, and the simplicity that is the exploding Blue Danube waltz, which is, again, Python's using its explosives budget to great effect.
Indeed.
Well, not to hammer home the deja vu aspect of this episode, but Nate, we've talked about the general theme of the episode and so it being sort of an Ouroboros of self-reflection. Do you want to talk to me about what your top three favorite sketches were?
I do. But before I do, I'd like to talk about my top three favorite sketches.
Excellent.
Number one is the Bishop rehearsing.
Mm.
Really at the heart of it, it's just a linking segment. And of course, what makes Python so unique is how they could really get away with never really ending their sketches. And so this is a way of introducing another way of getting out of having to end a sketch. But I really love just how useless this character is. Even by his own admission, he's like, no, I'm not here for you. I'm not in this episode. I'm just here reading my lines. Like, go over there. Like, that's as useful as he can get as...
A bit awkward, huh?
Yes.
I'm a bit stuck.
Well, try over there.
Right. And yeah, it's nothing to do with me, mate.
Like, why is it a bishop? I can only imagine. They have some costumes in the BBC wardrobe. It probably couldn't be a military person because that might make some sense in that kind of context. But if you have a bishop standing out in rural England, it doesn't make so much sense. So it makes the whole kind of fourth wall breaking transition just a little stranger. And we mentioned that he makes the line that character, this is show 5, and in fact, it's show 3.
He says that he will come back in episode 8. Episode 8, because this season is aired wildly out of production order, ends up coming in as episode 6 of series 2, or episode 19, if you're counting all of them together.
Mm-hmm.
According to Daryl Larson's complete all the references, that's when he claims Palin comes back as the bishop, because that's the only time in which Palin wears this outfit again, where you have three bishops rushing on stage after Mrs. Scum's appearance on the game show. So he does not say, "Oh, Mr. Belpit, your legs are so swollen." So it's not quite the same return. I don't know if his character was disappointed that after all that work of all those different various accents, some racist, some not.
"Oh, Mr. Belpit, your legs are so swollen. Oh, Mr. Belpit."
That his line was cut, but that's the closest we can get in terms of an actual return of that character.
I think I just enjoy how useless he is. useless to the context of the other character in the scene, but just how useful he is to us at how ridiculous and bad actor-y he is.
Right. Anybody that's had a one-line scene is familiar with the concept of, oh God, I've got to put my spin on this particular line. I've got to emphasize the one word. I've got to make myself stand out with 8 words of dialogue. How is that possible? So that actorly trope of obsessing over all the different ways in which a line could be read is instantly recognizable.
What is my motivation? Not to talk about my own acting career on this podcast, but such as it is, there have been plenty of times I've had a single line, and I don't really put a whole lot of stock into it. I just make sure that I don't flub it so that the production is held up by me.
Right.
You don't want to be that actor. And I feel like the bishop who talks about Mr. Belpit's swollen legs, he would be that actor.
Yes, he would not be the actor who throws his line away in order to make it the most accurate and true to the moment. He would want it to be all about him to the detriment of the entire production.
And making yourself unremarkable. That's a real trick.
It is a real trick. In a job that's about wanting to do something so you get noticed, so you get your next job, it must be incredibly difficult to balance that with, I'm just part of the background and my job is to not be noticed.
When
your whole body is saying, notice me so that I can be employed again next week.
Yeah. All right, I can give you my second favorite.
Hit me.
The poet Ewan McTeagle.
Form the breathtaking backdrop against which Ewan McTeagle writes such poems as, "Lend us a quid to the end."
I'm kind of fascinated by this answer. I have long felt that the Ewan McTeagle series of linked bits in this faux documentary, I don't want to call it a low point for Python, but I generally consider it to be not very funny. And so I'm interested in anybody that would isolate it out from this episode, let alone this season.
Hmm. Okay. If I could just call it Scottish racism, is not an unknown handle to pull for the Pythons. all the way back, even in the Frost Report, they were doing it. And as we've seen in series one with Angus Podgorny, it's something it's a ride they'd ridden before. I don't know what the response was from the northern neighbor to England, but what I find funny about it is definitely that cinematic documentary feel, how they have multiple different characters. You have the very weird sitting in an inflatable couch John Cleese character.
McTeagle has developed and widened his literary scope. 3 years ago, he concerned himself with quite small sums, quick bits of ready cash, sixpences, shillings. But more recently, he has turned his extraordinary literary perception to much larger sums.
And you have Michael Palin as the kind of subdued, definitely moronic poetry critic.
What McTeagle's poetry is doing is rejecting all the traditional cliches of modern pottery.
But just how the quality of every poem relies on how much money he talks about. There's got to be some kind of younger step-sibling hatred between England and Scotland, which the Pythons are really leaning hard into. But man, I just find it funny how it's like his biggest creation was Can I Have 50 Pounds? That was his greatest achievement.
Right. Can I have 50 pounds to mend the shed?
Can I have 50 pounds to mend the shed? I'm right on my uppers. I can pay you back when this postal order comes.
A couple notes on that. I mean, yes, obviously, to talk about the racist portrayal of the Scots as being money-grubbing as a nation, a coupon-clipping, penny-pinching essential characteristic. Bizarrely enough, that hadn't even occurred to me that was part of the root of the episode. To me, it was about the flip side of poetry, that you have a serious poetry critic, that you have Eric Idle dressed up in a astonishingly Shakespeare sexual portrayal of a king reading the poem, Can I Have 50 Pounds to Mend the Shed? That all of that is about elevating poetry that is basically just requests for money. That to me, the root of the sketch is that he's not writing poems. He's asking for cash, and everybody's thinking that they're poems, that they're turning it into an elevated form when really what he just needs is money. And yet they're like, oh, this is so beautiful. That to me is the word escapes me, but that is the comedic conceit, is the misunderstanding of his intent, that he's not actually a poet at all. And from that perspective, perhaps the poems themselves don't really work for me.
As poems.
Right. Are you familiar with William McGonagall?
I am not.
William McGonagall is frequently referred to as the worst writer in the English language, and is particularly famous for having once written a poem about a train disaster where 75 people died. Everybody in the train perished because a bridge collapsed underneath it. And he once wrote a poem for Sunlight Soap in order to get a 2 shilling prize. Actually, now I'm going to pause and see, was it a 2 shilling prize or a 2 pound prize? 2 guineas. It was awarded 2 guineas in response to writing a poem in praise of Sunlight Soap, to which he then wrote another poem in reply saying, I can write you more poems if you want. And the poem is hilarious and terrible in equal regard, including ending with a couplet where the rhyming word is his name and address. Let me read you a couple of lines here. Gentlemen, you have my best wishes, and I hope that the poem I've written about Sunlight Soap will cause a demand for it in every clime, for I declare it to be super fine. And I hope before long, without any joke, you'll require some more of my poems about Sunlight Soap. And in conclusion, gentlemen, I thank ye. William McGonagall, poet, 48 Step Road, Dundee.
Do you know if he predates this sketch?
Oh, yeah. very much earlier on than that. We've got the Dundee Courier here writing in 1894 about him. So he, there's a good chance he would have been infamous in the time of the Pythons as one of those people who was anthologized as awful. So Daryl Larson and a couple of other people have drawn comparisons between McGonagall and McTeagle. I wouldn't have made the connection myself, although when I was directed to his official website of McGonagall-online.org.uk, and they mentioned his poem about the Tay Bridge disaster, I was like, oh yes, I have heard this before. I have heard him listed as the worst writer of all time.
I feel like this, all that would have been known to the English public.
I think so, yes.
But to me, that's all lost. Like, I don't have any feeling good or ill towards the Scots. I fully acknowledge this is 50 years aged.
Right.
And to me, this is just like a funny setting where the guy wears a kilt, has a ridiculous beard, and I just love how like pissed off he is all the time.
Right.
I find it to be funny. Definitely with the sort of Macbethian portrayal by Eric Idle on stage.
That one, I was also very much indebted to both Larson and Pixley for providing me with lost contemporary context, because I've always thought that Idle's shirtless portrayal of some sort of Shakespearean performance, I had in my brain, in fact, the notes that I wrote down as I was watching this for this broadcast, I wrote down that he was a shirtless Lear. But apparently, this is a fairly accurate recreation of Ian McKellen in Richard II.
No way.
Yes. Ian McKellen in 1969 had performed Richard II and Edward II in the Edinburgh Fringe. He was 31 years old at the time, and in 1970 on the BBC, he did a one-man show about Keats, and he played T.E. Lawrence in a show called Ross by Terence Rattigan. Like, this was the national ascendancy of Ian McKellen. These 2 years of, like, everybody knowing that he was going to be our preeminent next amazing young actor. And so this would have been, I think, to audiences at the time, possibly an image that they would have seen and recognized from entertainment newspapers, even if they hadn't gone to the shows themselves.
Sir Ian McKellen, if you're listening, please call in and we can confirm or deny this rumor. Moving on, the third favorite sketch.
Timmy!
Moving on, the third favorite sketch. Deja vu. I have always liked this sketch, and we've talked about this at the top a little bit. I'm trying to think of like where officially this sketch starts.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you. Do you include the psychiatric milkman in this sketch? Because, of course, our show host from It's the Mind gets on the milk float and goes to see Dr. Cream. Like, can you extricate these two sketches? Or in fact, are they two sketches?
I think they're two different sketches.
Okay.
So for my putting this up as the third favorite sketch, starts with the music for It's the Mind.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Palin hit the desk and he's talking about It's the Mind. And he has a monologue, which he then kind of seamlessly starts to repeat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the start, is with the music.
Okay.
There is a comic thing, I'm not quite sure what you call it, psychological phenomenon, where if you repeat something enough, the sort of humoristic response ebbs and flows.
Mm.
And a couple of years ago, I was listening to Radiolab, and they talked about this. And the comedian Kristen Schaal, who I'm sure you know of, she's
love Kristen Schaal.
The Concords.
Yes.
In her stand-up routine, which I did see back when you could actually go to comic shows, she played off this idea where she and her comic partner, a guy by the name of Kurt Brownoller.
Oh, yes.
They would do a made-up song, and they would repeat the main line of the song a good, like, 50 or 60 times. And the refrain was only a few seconds, and then they'd repeat it over again. And the recording they had on Radiolab was, there's some laughter at first, and then after, like, seven repetitions, it's just bone quiet. There's no humor. People just, they're getting bored. And they can't really believe that they paid money to come see this show with this idiot on stage. But he keeps on going. Mm. And once he gets to like 30, 40 repetitions, the humor just picks up again. And this is justifiably something which is never really explored, because you have to deal with this dead space of not funny, almost anger at the performers. But I feel like this is where Deja Vu could have pushed the sketch. They just didn't have time to. So this is the concluding thought I had to the original thesis I presented at the beginning.
I really am intrigued to track down this Radiolab episode, because that phenomenon you've talked about is so much more elevated when you wrap it in the crispy bacon we had before the war of Kristen Schaal and Kurt Braunohler. The example I was going to bring up is something my brother Peter talks about all the time, where something goes from lightly funny to annoying to funny again. He always brings up the example of Peter Griffin fighting the guy in the chicken suit from Family Guy, where you think at first this is going to be a 2-second gag because it's Family Guy and their whole brand is 2-second gags. And then it continues to go and go and go. And you spend so much time wondering, wait, why hasn't this ended yet? That eventually you just start laughing at how long it's. The humor equivalent of an abusive relationship, when you put it in Family Guy terms, but I'm willing to give it the benefit of the doubt for Schaal and Braunohler.
Another example of this, not played out quite to the extent either Kristen Schaal or Family Guy went to, is even in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
I was thinking you were going to say this.
Where you have the scene of Lancelot assaulting...
Approaching
Swamp Castle. It's... I don't remember how many repetitions of the film bit, but it's got to be like 5 or so. And when you reach 3, you're like, what am I watching?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe by the 5th point, you're like, wait, that's just the same film bit. It may be more the shock that, oh no, he's not getting any closer. It's the same thing.
Anything that's a violation of the rule of 3 is automatically fascinating, because you're like, wait, it didn't do it that time. What's going on? What's going to happen next?
Yeah. It has always bugged me that there is never water in Palin's glass.
Yeah, especially the second time when he's definitely just drinking out of a totally dry glass. It's very noticeable, but I'm sure they tried it with water at one point, and I bet it was really tough mechanically.
To not just wear the water afterwards.
Right. And to fill it quickly and cleanly off screen during those couple of seconds.
Right. My thought exactly, maybe just it was just too much for the props. I always love how the mustache migrates its way around Palin or at Cherry Jones's face. It's a silly, stupid thing, but man, I just love that.
I don't think I ever noticed it. I'd noticed before when they are calling to complain, when they're complaining about the BAFTA representative's uniform.
I would like to point out that the BALPA spokesman was wearing the British Psychiatric Association Dinner Dance Club cufflinks.
Yes, I noticed that too.
And so you have Cleese as a Highland spokesman in a huge plaid tam o' shanter, and you've got Jones as the future, who we eventually discover is Dr. Cream at the Dairy Institute. His mustache swaps only once, I think, during that exchange of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always noticed that. But until this watch, I'd never noticed that in the 3 studio bits that happen after the filmed repetition of Palin's character running from the milk float into the dairy, that his mustache goes from below his nose to up his nose to... I think gone, or is it up on his forehead? Where is it in the 3rd location?
It's just underneath his eyeballs.
Okay. I was focusing so much on his lip that I didn't look at the rest of his face.
So it's something about the repetition of it.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned already, Palin's increasingly frenetic, frantic performance, which is delightful to watch.
Ian McNaughton, the frequent director-producer of most of the early seasons of Monty Python's Flying Circus, in an interview in 1998, specifically singled out this sketch for Palin's performance, saying how good it was, which I think is incredibly high praise that many years later, that episode stood and that performance stood out to him in the whole of Python's sketches.
That he remembered and singled that one out.
Right. I think says something about the technical aspect of it. So even though it does sort of end with a damp squib and a fade out underneath the credits, the couple minutes leading up to that are just extraordinarily good, effective Python. I don't have a note here as to who wrote the sketch. It's Palin Jones for almost everything in this episode. They wrote the Milkman Psychiatrist. They wrote the poetry of Ewan McTeagle. They wrote the aeroplane cockpit. And they wrote the... Actually, I don't have a note as to who wrote Flying Lessons at the very beginning. But It feels like almost top to toe a Palin Jones episode. Which is interesting in and of itself that somehow it shook down that way in the writing process.
Well, as you mentioned at the top, the election night special would have been the bookend of this particular episode. That for sure would have been more Chapman Cleese, idol even, but it didn't really work out that way.
Right. So originally intended to have a slightly greater balance, but as broadcast is really a highlight to just the breadth of skill of the Palin Jones collaboration.
All right, listeners, now we come to the portion of the podcast where we pick a minute from within the episode and we have a little bit of a back and forth about it. So what is going to happen is that we're going to pick a minute and my compadre Ben will watch that minute and we'll give a 30-second summary of that minute. And then I will ask him six questions, six trivia questions pertaining to something within that 60 seconds of Monty Python Series 2, Episodes 3/16, Deja Vu. So go ahead and watch minute 25.
Oi! Mr. Boatman, your great legs is all swollen.
All right, Ben, we'll summarize this minute in 30 seconds, starting now.
Graham Chapman, dressed as a housewife, walks past a through a stream, past a tea trolley, and the woods, and being led by the milkmaid. He looks back, and as if he's seen them someplace before, they then pass Michael Palin as a bishop, reading, "Mr. Belpit, are you, your legs are so swollen?"
10 seconds.
And has a start. It then cuts to the It the Mind title sequence, and Michael Palin introduces it and stops and says it again and begins to repeat himself.
Time. Yes, it goes a lot faster than you think.
It really does.
Okay, I have... six questions for you, Ben.
Alrighty.
Pertaining to something or things that appear in minute 25.
Revenge is a dish best served dry, like yesterday's turkey.
Question one. At the very start of the 25th minute, we see Carol Cleveland meeting Graham Chapman's character. In the first setting, the two pass a rabbit, which soon explodes. Exploding animals is an ongoing gag of the episode, but this question focuses specifically on rabbits. Which of the following is not true of rabbits? A. In modern Israeli Hebrew, the word rabbit is used in much the same way as the word chicken is, to denote someone who is fearful or scared. B. Both the rabbit and the hare, a distant genetic cousin of the rabbit, are indistinguishable at birth. This led to many comical, if harrowing, situations in 18th century European royal families, where the much more aggressive and physical hare, given as gifts, but initially mistaken for rabbits, overpowered young princes and princesses. C. In the UK, rabbits are banned from ferries. Legend has it that bunnies being transported for food chewed through the hull of a 17th century ship, causing the deaths of many sailors. Or is it D, the island nation of Malta consumes more rabbit per person than any other country? The Maltese national dish, stuffed talfennik, is a sort of red wine and tomato stew using rabbit.
Ooh, I was pretty sure it was A until D. Of course, now that I've narrowed it down to those two, it'll be something else. A.
No, it is in fact B. Hares are born with their eyes open, hair covering their bodies, hair, H-A-I-R, and they can run within a few minutes after birth. Rabbits, on the other hand, are born blind, naked, and remain in a fur-lined nest for the first few days of their lives. Question two. In the opening sequence to the talk show, It's the Mind, we were shown not one, but two images of men looking through optical microscopes. Although the origins of the field of psychiatry can be dated potentially all the way back to the ancient Egyptians, the use of microscopes to examine sections of the brain, posthumously, of course, as a diagnostic tool came into use obviously much later. In fact, the method known as serial sectioning, where thin sequential slices of brain were placed on slides for you guessed it, analysis under a microscope, became widespread. Approximately what year did serial sectioning become the primary tool of neurological physiology? Is it A, 1865, B, 1885, C, 1905, or D, 1925?
Well, it was just B, so it's unlikely to be B again, so B.
You are correct. Yay! It is B. To quote a 2006 review paper in the research publication Studies in History and Philosophy of Biological and Biomedical Sciences, quote, in the mid-1870s, the two standard methods in the anatomical study of the human brain were defibering and freehand sectioning. By the mid-1880s, the two had been largely surpassed by serial sectioning.
My household, serial sectioning is when you got those individual boxes of cereal for your birthday.
Question 3. The phrase déjà vu, despite itself being a French grammatical construct, is quite well known in American parlance. What is less well known is that the phrase déjà vu is but one of a host of neurological anomalous oddities plucked from the French language.
Oui.
It is the Alec of the Baldwin brothers, so to speak. According to Wikipedia, which of the following is not an accepted French-based phrase describing psychological oddities? Is it A, jamais vu? Jamais vu involves a sense of eeriness and the observer's impression of seeing the situation for the first time, despite rationally knowing that he or she has been in the situation before. Is it B, presque vu? Is the intense feeling of being on the very brink of a powerful epiphany, insight, or revelation? Or is it C, lorsque vu, or when seen? The delayed recognition of a known acquaintance when they appear far outside their usual context.
Lorsque vu.
That is correct, though it is very much a real thing.
Is it?
It is just not called that, according to Wikipedia.
Okay, what's it really called?
I don't know. That's outside the purview of this quiz.
All right, fine.
It's like seeing your professor at the supermarket. Question 4. Returning again to the opening sequence for It's the Mind, one of the images we are shown is of Terry Jones balancing an egg on his head.
Yes.
In fact, egg balancing is a very real activity. Once a traditional Chinese practice, it was since been popularized in the United States starting around the end of the Second World War. Egg balancing, a competitive activity where eggs are perched upright on the more blunted side of their long axis on a static surface, and egg stacking, an activity where eggs are placed on top of each other on a body part, are both monitored by the Guinness Book of World Records. Which of the following is not a world record for egg balancing?
Okay.
Is it A, Brian Spots of Kano, Colorado, balances 900 eggs within 26 hours? Or is it B, Muhammad Mukbel of Kuala Lumpur, balances 3 eggs vertically on top of each other within 1 minute? Is it C, Finn Mertens of Dendermonde, Belgium, stacks 154 eggs on his abdomen? Or is it D, Jack Harris of London, England, stacks 18 eggs on the back of his hand?
All right, I have no idea. 900 eggs in a minute.
Actually, the correct answer is C. The correct answer, of course, being incorrect. The Belgian did not stack 154. Though if you do the math, 154 eggs would be a stack of eggs 9 long and 6 wide, balanced up in a pyramid formation. Just so we know.
So you're saying we should try it after the podcast.
If you want to go buy a couple hundred eggs, yeah, you should go try it. Yeah. Question 5. Michael Palin makes an appearance as the bishop. He is seen holding a script and rehearsing his one line, "Oh, Mr. Belpit, your legs are so swollen." The word Belpit is quite an obscure choice for the Pythons to have written for this character. Does the word Belpit mean A, anvil in Finnish, B, bell tower in Scottish Gaelic, C, louse in Native Hawaiian, D, pinky finger in Estonian, or E, none of the above?
I'm going to go with none of the above.
You are correct.
Hey!
Since I cannot prove a negative, I couldn't say something else.
Can't say it doesn't mean anything
at all.
It doesn't
mean anything at all. I was expecting it to mean something in some language, but Finally, question 6, the last question in this Monty Python Minute quiz. The song that introduces It's the Mind is an eerie mix of looped electric guitar and peculiar synthesizer entitled Eye of Horus, brackets, deja vu, brackets, by Peter Wilshire and Keith Chester, and is available on the DeWolf Music Presents Monty Python's Flying Circus. Although it serves as a captivating soundscape, it is, in my opinion, a rather unsettling, if abrasive piece of music that can only be listened to once per sitting, if that. Amazingly, the song was sampled and used as background in another single released sometime within the last 50 years. Is it A, Peter Wilshire by Mello Robinson in 2007, or B, Burn It All Down Quickly, Quickly, Quickly by Battery Noise in 1995, C, Chaotic Whimsy by The Fidget Splinters in 2013, or D, To Find Is to Lust and Other Grand Spatial Temporal Fixings by Adirondacks in 1983.
I don't think Fidget Splinters is a real thing. but the other ones probably could be. I'm going to go with Adirondacks.
The correct answer is A, Peter Wilshire by Mello Robinson, 2007. Mello Robinson's reimagining of this song was simply to record himself giving long, rambling rants about things he hates on top of the already sonically difficult original. Robinson's album title, quote, "This album is disorganized and I mostly hate it, but listen anyways," unquote, sums up my feelings most accurately. Weirdly, there's sufficient electronic vocal distortion to make the rants mostly unintelligible, which leaves me wondering, maybe that's the point? Okay, Ben, you have 50%, 3 out of 3 on the question portion, plus I think a pretty stellar summary in the 30 seconds. So you have won this episode's Monty Python Minute.
Hey!
Wonderful.
Well, let's head on to the moments.
The 5 top moments. Just to remind our listeners, a favorite moment is a short bit of film, acting, cartoon, or skit of any kind, which is not necessarily a full skit, but is something that just makes us reflect, smile, or just genuinely happy. Ben, do you have a moment to share?
It would be easy for me to pick all 5 of my moments from the flying lessons sketch at the beginning of the episode.
So you want to learn to fly?
Yes.
Right, well, up on the table, arms out, fingers together, knees bent.
No.
Up on the table!
I think there are so many good things about it. It is a sketch that is frequently referenced by Mark Kermode of the Kermode and Mayo film review on BBC Five Live, particularly where he says,
"Pardon me, but I'm off to play the grand piano."
I think that must have a lot of resonance to people who are aware of class differences in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Not to put too fine a point on it, Mark is also of a certain age. And so I think that sketch was part of his upbringing, and it must have spoken to him particularly. But I will say the way in which Chapman's character really drives home the class distinctions with Anne Hoop.
"Eaton and Magdalen, the hoop has an hole in. Course it's got an hole in, it wouldn't be a hoop otherwise, would it, Mod?" Oh, a gop. A gop in one's hoop.
The line delivery, the timing, so many good things about that sketch, but basically the way it devolves into a minute of just saying,
isn't,
after the dressing down because of language pronunciation differences. Oh boy, that is a touchstone sketch for me, and a gop in one's oop is the summary of that.
My number one would have been, "I'm off to play the grand piano," G-R-A-H-N-D, grand
right,
piano.
Right.
Yes. Love it.
Weirdly enough, I think it's Larson who points out that it's all written out phonetically in the script, that they don't usually do that. For example, it's classic Python knowledge to understand that when you read the script for Nudge Nudge, it doesn't make sense on the page. But this particular sketch was written out in such a way that you could understand what was going on by reading out vaguely phonetic pronunciations of the differences in the delivery of the words, so that there was no mistaking it. I wonder if it was written at least in part in mind so that somebody else could understand what was going on. Either way, you're right. G-R-A-H-N-D. Is all the difference in the world.
All right. One favorite mode of mine is a quote-unquote very good playwright listing off poets.
"Keats's Seasons of Mismel Fruitfulness. Wordsworth's I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud. And Milton's Can You Lend This Two Bob Till Tuesday?"
Chalking this up to a well-executed rule of three. It's a very well-used trope to employ this rule. And to have the third one just be a bit more zany, or in this case, a lot more zany, as he lists first 2 real, very real poems, and finishing off with a very real poet who slips into the same thing that McTeagle does and just begging for money.
I don't have anything to add except to agree with you that it's a very well-structured joke. For my number three, I'm going to go with when Michael Palin's performer character is riding on the milk float to the psychiatrist's dairy. He puts a newspaper up in front of his face so that you can then cut to Michael Palin as the bishop saying, "Oh, Mr. Belpit, your legs are so swollen," behind him in a way that's very similar to when Carol Cleveland's dairy maid is walking Graham Chapman's Mrs. Ratbag through to the dairy. You then have the second secretary of Jeanette Wild, who looked so much like Carol Cleveland's secretary out in the field, playing Carol Cleveland in the field from behind, so that you can have these characters doubled for themselves with a simple amount of prop. Like, the amount of thought that went into the production of those filmed bits so that you can have characters see themselves effectively or exist on the screen with just a little bit of blocking, just with their back turned or with a newspaper in front of their face. I think this probably was one of the most production juggled episodes. There doesn't seem to be any indication that it was a pain in the neck. So it's good inventiveness. And I enjoyed noticing that and being like, oh, clever boys. Well done.
Very good. Another favorite moment of mine is, so there is an ongoing gag of animals exploding, which I find really delightful. But there is a filmed portion where the Jersey Dairy Psychiatric Association, whatever the name is driving in front of a zoo. And there are no pyrotechnics going on, but all you hear are explosions.
Yeah, it's sort of the opposite of what I was just saying.
That may have been a want to have an actual zoo with nothing but explosions going off. Definitely beyond the budget, but it cost them nothing to film a sign saying zoo and then add on crappy audio of explosions in the background in post. It's a subtle joke, but I love it.
Yeah, I think it's even perhaps a little too subtle in that it does 100% go. And if you're not really paying attention, it's an insert and a payoff that doesn't work. But it is one of those things that rewards multiple viewings, I think.
Yeah. Okay, Ben, your fifth moment.
Well, I don't want to dwell. I could go off on a long tangent about this. It didn't end up being one of the focuses of the episode because we often focus on what works in the episode as opposed to what doesn't. But I did expect that you might ask me about the roots of the fly this plane to Cuba joke.
Will you fly this plane to Luton, please?
Well, this is a scheduled flight to Cuba.
Because sometimes you're like, is this a thing, Ben? Is this a thing that people really focused on? And I did find an article from CNN in 2017 that talked about a rash of skyjackings that took place. In fact, there were over 30 U.S. flights diverted to Cuba in 1968 alone. Two in one day. That it was a huge thing that I always sort of associated with jokes from Mad Magazine and political cartoons because I grew up post all this. And so therefore, the world had changed to prevent these things from happening. There was a window of about 5 years where there was a pretty good chance that somebody in an act of political defiance would divert a plane full of passengers to Cuba.
I want you to fly this plane to Luton, please.
Right, well, I'd better turn the plane around then.
And I think it's kind of played territory. The political cartoons in Private Eye and in various newspapers, I think they were sort of reaching into territory that was not Python-esque when they did that sketch. However, when Michael Palin's character lands in a haystack and goes to meet a bus.
Take this bus to Cuba.
And the bus changes its directions from straight to Luton to straight to Cuba. I thought that was pretty wonderful, especially because doing a little bit of research into the directions of where that haystack was. Let's see if I can get this correct. He would have been dumped in a haystack in Basingstoke, which is, weirdly enough, on the flight path from Heathrow to Cuba. It is southwest of London, but therefore there would have been no direct route from Basingstoke to Luton. You would have gone via London, and it would have taken about an hour and a quarter to get there by car, and therefore even longer by bus. So there's no straight to Luton bus, Python. But the gag of the straight to Luton sign rotating up to straight to Cuba Cuba is a good, dumb enough gag that I really enjoyed it.
This is an interesting joke because I don't really understand the, you know, the geopolitical Scotland versus UK dynamic, which is prevalent in the Ewan McTeagle and other jokes in the series. But I'm aware of Cuba, and I'm aware of the history of Cuba. So it kind of making an appearance, it's like, it seems like that is more relevant to me as an American. So I did a little bit of a research Wikipedia dive on this. And yeah, 50s, 60s, and 70s, there's a spate of hijackings. A lot of them were flights out of Miami, but they didn't have to have John Cleese pull out the submachine gun and say, take this bus to Cuba, though that whole thing is physically impossible and therefore funny. Had they not have done that, I probably would not have been, oh, it's just some guy who's trying to hijack a plane. Mm. But of course, given the tension of flying in a plane around that time, especially out of, you know, South Florida area, it's definitely more of a satire. And I can see that we talk about the shelf life of a joke.
Right.
I can see that the shelf life is still in the satire, like the needle is still pointing towards satire in that joke. But that's more because...
As opposed to pure absurdism.
As opposed to, yeah, zany madcap, as we mentioned. But that's mostly because it pertains more to my side of the hemisphere of the planet.
As opposed to the sort of the overarching theme of flight that runs throughout the thing, because we have the flying lesson that leads into that, where it is totally zany madcap to have a man just suspended over his desk. There doesn't need to be any context for that. It's just absurd.
Right. It's so funny. Usually Cleese is very front and center in his performance, but this one he's... Aside from the crazy guy on the inflatable love seat, he's very background.
Yeah, and his particular performance in the cockpit as the co-pilot or pilot, depending on your perspective, is the timing in that sketch in general is odd.
Mm-hmm.
They were directed to underplay it, I think.
Well, that's the great thing about these modern airliners. I mean, I can keep this plane flying with only the smallest movement, and Pancho here doesn't have to move at all.
that's marvelous.
And so it's all very casual, and therefore it doesn't punch.
Yeah. Wow, fantastic.
Okay.
This episode of the Python Perspective sub-episode of Farced Perspective was conceived, researched, and performed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. Sound design also by the two of us.
The theme song is by John Philip Sousa and sourced by Creative Common Clips from the archive.org community.
Editing was done mostly by Ben. You can find us at farcedperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at farcednamebasis. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the context and lasting power of comedy. In this case, the comic phenomenon known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
If there are things, dates, facts, names, airplane hijackings, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please feel free to contact us via the website, and we will post it to our errata page on farcedperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interests. Bumped my mic stand. Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest.
Are you sure this isn't an episode of Deja Vu?
I just don't want to get my line wrong.
Oh, Mr. Belpit,
your legs are so swollen. Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Nathan. My co-host is Ben.
Rotten, rotten. You're an utter bloody washout.
See you next time when we discuss episode 4 of series 2, The Buzz Aldrin Show.